This last Sunday was the Sunday of the Prodigal Son, which is a very well-known story, well-known parable. And what's interesting about it is that immediately after, on Monday, the readings were from the Epistle of St. John and also from the Gospel of St. Mark. In the Gospel readings, beginning on Monday, immediately we are jumping to the night of the betrayal of Christ by Judas. Mm-hmm. On one hand, in terms of the Gospel readings, and on the other hand, in terms of the Epistle readings, the first Epistle of St. John, which is all about love and about the relationship between people and God, the relationship that exists between love of people and love of God, that dynamic. And that's a really interesting juxtaposition. And really have to think about it. Why does the church present these seemingly very different readings, or in terms of what is being spoken about? On one hand, you have the scene of Christ being betrayed, being arrested, being mocked, spat upon, beaten, and condemned to death. And on the other hand, you have St. John writing about the love of God and how we are to love God. Another thing I wanted to do in this Bible study, just as a side point, is we're not here to analyze the Bible. We're not here to dissect it. We are here to be taught by it. We are here to be inspired and to be moved and to see what is God saying to me in my heart when I read this passage. And that's different for every person. That's different for me and you. But we have to be willing to enter into that way of thinking rather than saying, well, I think it means this when I read this passage. I have to maybe just remain silent and say in my heart, what is it saying to me? So as we're reading, we're going to take a little moment and just kind of be silent for a little bit and see what moves in you. And if you want to share that, you can. If not, you don't have to. So let's begin. Today is what we call Thursday, of course, of meat fair. Meat fair is a funny kind of word that we use in the church to indicate, beginning on Monday, all the way through this coming Saturday or Sunday, is the last day to eat meat. So the church prepares us little by little for Great Lent. And so this is the last week we are supposed to eat meat. And then this coming Sunday will be Judgment Sunday, and that all of next week is we call, again in a funny term, Cheese Fair Week, because it's the last week we're supposed to be eating dairy. Yeah. That's it. Get all your dairy, enjoy all that cheese pizza, because come the following Monday, Clean Monday, the fast begins, Great Lent begins, and our journey to the resurrection begins. And so the church is very merciful. It gives us, slowly lets us enter into this period of fasting rather than all at once, okay? Because we need that. We're very weak. So let's read. I am in 1 John chapter 4, verse 20. And what 1 Epistle of John, chapter 4.
The Gospel of John.
The first book of John. The Epistle of John, yeah. And as you're finding it, the Epistle of John is written, some believe, that around the same time as he wrote his Gospel, which is in the year approximately AD 90. In the year 90 AD, and He is at this time either still banished, if you will, to the island of Patmos. And the themes he covers are, again, our communion with God and with each other, the relationship of faith, love, and obedience, the relationship between love of God and love of others, how important it is to have the true faith, because at this time there was something, a heresy called, or a group of people, I should say, who had some heretical teachings. They were known as the Gnostics. And what they believed was that the body didn't matter, that the body was evil. Only the spirit mattered. Only your spirit and your soul mattered. Essentially, that this whole world was just a bad dream, a bad illusion. And all you need to do is just, as you know, live for your soul, and the body needs to be completely rejected. They didn't understand how God works through the material world. They didn't accept that. They couldn't understand how. And of course, that's completely contradicting to what Christianity is, which is very incarnational, right? God coming through to us through matter, through the flesh. So that he's partly writing against that heresy as well. All right, so 1 John 4. And it's 1 John 4:20 through chapter 5, verse 21. And I will start reading. If someone says, "I love God," and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother, whom he has seen, how can he love God, whom he has not seen? And this commandment we have from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also. Okay. Want to continue reading a little bit, Arthur?
Okay. It sounds like King James stuff. Whosoever believeth that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and everyone that loveth him that begat. Yeah. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ. Okay, the first line. Okay. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and everyone who loves him, who begot, oh, that's a weird, everyone who loves him who begot?
Let's see.
This is simple. It doesn't make sense to me.
Okay, let's try again. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and everyone who loves him, who begot also, who he begot also loves him who is begotten of him. So now we are in 1 John 5. It jumps to 1 John 5. Let's see how it's written here. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. And everyone who loves him who begot also loves him who is begotten of him. Yeah, it is an interesting tongue twister.
It's a word missing or something.
It's the same description here, same text here. So, whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. And everyone who loves him, who begot, oh, I see. And everyone who loves him who begot, comma, right?
Whom he begot, or whom was begotten?
Well, whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ mm-hmm. is born of God. Mm-hmm. And everyone who loves him, that is God, who begot, in other words, since the God is the one who begot, who begets his believers, right? They are born of him. Okay. So it's basically saying whoever believes in Jesus is the Christ, is born of God, right? And everyone who loves him, who loves God, the one who begot them, mm-hmm. is the parentheses.
Okay.
The Father.
Right? Also loves him, Christ, who is begotten of him, God, the Father. So that's a very important kind of a triangle we could set up, that imagine this triangle, and on one end you have God the Father on the top, you have human beings on one corner, and on Christ on the other corner, and now you have a triangle. So since Christ comes from God the Father, he's begotten of the Father, that means those who love Christ, who is begotten of the Father, are also loved by him who begot Christ, and Christ loves them, because now they are also begotten of the Father through him. So it's this kind of circle or triangle, as you will. That's what this is saying. By this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and keep his commandments. So who are the children of God? Is it just any human being in the world? Or is it specifically those who know and love Christ and know and love the Father and are born of God by knowing Christ and loving Christ?
That's the tough part.
Yeah.
That's the tough part where the extension to some difficult to love some people.
Right. Yes, it is difficult. That's the difficult love, exactly. But there is a sense here that the children of God St. John uses this phrase very carefully. We tend to say that all the human beings in the world are the children of God. And in some sense, that's correct. If you believe you came from a creator, then in a kind of, general sense, you could say, then you are a child of God. But that's not the way St. John is using this word. He means it specifically for the Christians who are joined to God, to Christ, through holy baptism. Because through baptism, we are adopted as children of God through Christ, right? Outside of that, you are not a child of God in the Christian sense. In order to be truly a child of God, you have to be adopted by him through baptism. Now that's a tough one. People find that hard to believe sometimes or accept. Any questions on that? Does that make sense? By this we know that we love the children of God, again, our fellow believers, when we love God and keep his commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. What are his commandments? Can you name some commandments?
To love God and to love your neighbor as yourself.
To love God, love your neighbor. What are some commandments?
But who is our neighbor?
Who's your neighbor? Oh, right.
That's, uh-huh. This, if you, if literally, if you're the children of God, and you could extend that to, well, if you're not baptized and Christian, you're not my neighbor.
That's a really good point. So here's where it gets...
I'm not sure that that's the right way to look at it. I don't think so.
No, I think you're right to make that observation. Because does that say we should only love Christians? Of course not. Right? But to take it contextually here, there is a sense that St. John is speaking to his community, right? He's writing this epistle to his Christian community and saying, have love amongst yourselves. Keep the faith, right? How can you say you love God when you're not taking care of your brother? Because remember now, the Christians are persecuted. Mm-hmm. They are fleeing. They are being hunted. And it's a very serious time, and there's real love happening, because at any moment, I could be betrayed by somebody because that person was worrying about their own neck. And is that love? No. So he's telling them, this is the moment of truth. Do you really love your brother? Right? And he says that to us too, right? Do I really love my neighbor, Christian or not? But contextually, in this particular verse, in this particular epistle, right, he's specifically referring to that. And we can, of course, take it and apply it to our lives and mean it also in the general sense that, yes, we should love. But I think we do have, as Christians, we do have a special obligation to love our fellow believers. Not more than others out in the world or non-Christians, but I think in a special way, because we are brothers and sisters, literally, because we all are adopted by God as his sons and daughters. So that makes us brothers and sisters. So there is a special love there that should exist amongst Christians, as it would in a family, right? There's a special love in a family. And in fact, we are called the family of God by Paul. Okay? Any other observations so far or questions?
I think that probably either we're probably required to apply that same consideration to others who are not of our faith or not of a not Christian, because we all of us, whether anyone that's walking around has from conception the Spirit of God.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for pointing that out. Right. They have the image and likeness of God embedded in them, imprinted in them by virtue of being a human being, right? Whether they realize it or not.
And accordingly, I think that what is asking us, perhaps there is a special relationship between us and or individually and the baptized Orthodox Christians or baptized Christians in another faith. But I think because each of us has got the Spirit of God, I think that is telling us that it's demanding that we care for Joe out here on the corner as much as we do the baptized Christians.
Right. And I think the the manner by which we are supposed to do this, yes, on an individual level, through acts of love and care for the stranger who is in need. But St. John is really hammering this point that you all, you Christians, if you say and if you are born of God, you need to be a community of love, which is a refuge a place, a safe harbor for others to come to.
The context of the time that
no,
they lived.
No. What I'm referring to is St. John is saying to his Christians, to his his parish, if you will, his community, saying, if you are born of God, if you are truly Christians, you need to be this place, this community of love, where others can come to and find healing, find God, find love. So he's telling them what a great responsibility they have to be a place where there's love. In the same way, our parish right here in Vallejo, we have a very, very great responsibility to be a place where there is love. When somebody comes to our through our doors, when somebody comes to our community, they should feel that. They should feel that there's something here, that God's love is here. And they see that in the people and how they interact with each other and how they love one another and how they welcome strangers and how they offer things back to the community. Right? That's what he's saying. It's like, this is who you are. Be who you are. Okay?
Yeah, I think there is something special about a community of believers. I mean, there's I don't know which Greek word for the love is being used here. Is it agape or Philadelphia? I mean,
I could find out. Yeah, I can find out.
Even if, I mean, it doesn't matter that much, but just, you know, that brotherly love between believers, sharing the same Father in a conscious way, you know, is like, it feels different than loving
Joe on the street.
Yeah, Joe on the street somehow, but I completely agree with you too. It's like, I mean, we're supposed to love our enemies too, so not just, certainly not just other Christians, but it's like a different, kind of a different quality love or something.
He's using here agapo.
Okay.
Which is agapo, which is agape.
Agape
love. You know, as you know, the five ways of expressing love the ancient Greeks had. Agapo is a kind of, it's used also in the modern Greek, you know, which means their love in general. But it's a very deep love that's more than friendship. That's phili. It's the kind of love, you know, you'd have in a family. Right? That's born out of a relationship. A very deep, trusting relationship of not of knowing somebody that you know that like a blood, right?
I liked what you said about you know being the home or the house of like a shining light on the hill, the place that attracts other people, and that has to be different than other kinds of love, or it wouldn't attract anybody somehow.
Right, because they are maybe receiving that other kind of love in whatever other way, through their spouse, through their friends. But this community has to be a place where you experience the love of God. Not merely human love, but another love, the higher love, if you will, the source of all love. And that's what he's getting at here, I think. And he says, well, by this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and keep his commandments, for this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. And what are his commandments? You said some of them, right? Love one another is one of them.
Love and pray for your enemies.
Pray for your enemies.
Feed the poor.
Right.
Visit the
and there's
sick.
Others, right?
Yeah.
Be holy. It's a commandment. Watch and pray. That's a commandment. He commands his disciples to watch and pray. Be vigilant. Forgive. It's a commandment. Deny yourself. That's a commandment. Those are all commandments. You can't just do one. You got to do them all.
Yeah.
So he's saying, this is how we know we really love God, if you're actually following his commandments. If you're not following his commandments, you probably don't love God as much as you think you do. So stop lying to yourself and to God and get serious and start following the commandments. Even if you fail at all of them, at least try. If you're not doing them at all, don't tell me you love God. That's what he's saying here. He's very serious. It's very black and white, right? We like to be more in the gray sometimes, but with God, some things are very black and white.
So it's not merely those that were written in stone at Sinai.
Exactly. It's in addition to the ones in the Ten Commandments that Moses received. Christ, if you read the New Testament, I think you'll find maybe 20 other new commandments that he gives. So, let's continue. I want to go back now for a moment, in the interest of time, to what is happening in the gospel reading. And let's do that. We'll go to Mark 15. Mark 15.
Pardon?
Mark chapter 15.
Mark 15.
Okay. Yeah. So again, here's the scene. Christ has been arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. The disciples flee. He is taken to the Sanhedrin in this mock trial, this fake trial in the middle of the night. Hardly anyone's there except all the ones who want to condemn him. False witnesses are being brought forth. He's being mocked and ridiculed, spat upon, beaten by the soldiers, and arrested, of course. And now we are here in the next morning. Right, this is all going on in the middle of the night. And now the next morning, we have this scene in Mark 15. You want to read, Dennis?
Okay. Immediately in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council. And they bound Jesus and led him away and delivered him to Pilate. Then Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered and said to them, "It is you who say." And the chief priests accused him of many things, but he answered nothing. Continue.
That's good. Right before this, I forgot to mention, of course, you have the very moving scene of Peter denying Christ as well, three times. And if you juxtapose this scene with what St. John is saying about loving God, knowing God, being loyal to his commandments, right? And now you have, again, the gospel reading juxtaposing that to something which is the complete opposite. People hating God, persecuting him, mocking him, denying him. That's the complete opposite. And what are we doing today, right? Do we love God today, or are we persecuting him? Are we mocking him? Where are we? And again, the church is showing this juxtaposition between these two relationships to God. You are either with him or you're denying him. You either love him or you hate him, right? Or you're indifferent. It's so clear how human nature really is.
Yeah, that's kind of the commonality too. I mean, there's a contrast, but there's also like a interesting commonality, because everyone fails.
Mm-hmm.
Peter fails,
mm-hmm.
and the people who are crucifying him fail.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone fails.
Exactly. That's a good point.
Yeah, it reminds me of that that from St. Paul of, you know, God has put everyone under disobedience to have mercy on all. So it's like, that's a free, for me, that's always a freeing teaching. It's like, okay, yeah, there's never, you can never live up. You have to try.
Exactly.
It's the heartfelt trying. But
it's that, the
that's
trying.
The difference I see here is he wept when he was.
Afterwards.
Yeah, and, but these guys are not repenting.
Right, and the truth is revealed. The truth is revealed.
Yeah. About Peter, the truth about himself and about...
About everybody.
About everybody, yeah.
And about Christ.
Yeah.
His great... How great his patience is, how great his humility is, how great his love is. Mm-hmm. All that is being revealed. Mm-hmm. The truth is coming out.
He was there to take all that on.
Right.
He just took it all on.
He took it all on. And why? Because he is above all this. And this is so many scenes in the Bible, and this is another one, where you see Christ in his human nature, his human heart, his human mind, his human presence, if you will, experiencing one thing, and at the same time, you see his divine will, his divine mind, his divine heart there as well. And at no time are they separate from another, or in conflict from one another, or arguing with one another, but they are completely one will. Right? Two natures, one will. Any other human being in this situation, I think, could not have endured this. Being absolutely innocent, yet not saying a single word in your defense, but remaining completely silent and allowing it to happen. Because remember, this is a man who has calmed the sea. This is the man who has raised the dead. This is the man who's fed 5,000 and more. Could he not have at any moment, as he said, called down legions of angels and just put an end to it right there? Of course he could have. But he says he doesn't. He restrains. Out of what? Why?
Love.
Exactly. And that's exactly what St. John in the epistle is getting at. An incomprehensible love. Only, I think, God can love in this way. But I think we can as well. And if that's the example, that's what we are supposed to strive towards, is to love as God loves. To love as God loves. That's what we're meant to do.
Yeah, and once in a while, like when I read about the, I forget which heresy it was, about the one nature as opposed to two natures. And sometimes I say, why does it matter?
The monophysite, yeah.
But in a way, if you didn't have the teaching of the two natures really upheld, then we wouldn't be able to get in touch with that reality about ourselves too, because we kind of have two natures.
Very good, yeah.
We have this deep self that kind of watches everything.
Mm-hmm.
And yet... It's not, but we have the other self, and they're not connected the way Christ's two selves are connected.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a nice observation. You're right. That we have, as you said, we're kind of fragmented in that way. Our heart wants to do one thing.
Yeah,
our mind does another. Even Christ says the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Mm-hmm. So we are fragmented. We are constantly being torn this way and that way. Mm-hmm. But Christ, as... Mm-hmm. Still a human being, tells us, no, it is possible for you to be perfect, for you to be whole and one, if you are joined to me, because I am one, and I am holy, and I am perfect, because I am one with my Father. So through me, you can have that oneness in yourself, and through with your brothers and sisters in this unity, and with God. No more fragmentation, no more division, no more, you know, dividing, which is what the devil does. He's diavolos, the divider.
And he wants us to do it through pride and effort. So that's the beautiful teaching. It's like it's through our weakness that we can be made perfect. But the devil wants us to, like, try and, you know, on our own and through pride.
Right. It's all me, me, me. Mm-hmm. I can do it. Mm-hmm. And again, that's, like you said, the greatest sin is... thinking I can do it on my own, and I don't need God.
It's the way I was thinking of it, it's the greatest burden. I I mean, we're tempted to it for some weird reason, mm-hmm. but it's so painful to be... Mm-hmm.
Even though it doesn't work, we keep being tempted to it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and it's more of a burden than...
It is more of a burden. It's a foolish. It's a foolishness, yeah. ultimately, yeah. but it's a good way to think of it as a burden. Why do we keep taking that on
yeah.
when we should instead enlist God's help, invite His help, and be joined to Him?
Yeah.
And I think that is partly because we are helpless in our foolishness. Our minds are not thinking clearly because they are broken. They are distorted from our fallen state.
Mm-hmm.
We think we're so wise and so advanced.
Mm-hmm.
We're fooling ourselves. Right? So, very good. Now, let's go back now. Well, so as you just read, they lead him away and deliver him to Pilate. And Pilate asks him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Christ answers, "It is, as you say." How is he the king of the Jews? In what sense? Why does Christ say, "Yes, I am the king of the Jews"?
Because he's God, and God is there is the king, the real king.
Okay. Any thoughts?
He's acknowledging, yes, he is.
Okay.
It's very clear.
I mean, it's kind of like, it reminds me of like in the Old Testament when the Hebrews wanted a human king and God said, "I'm your king. But if you want a human king, go ahead and then you'll see what happens." They're up against politics. You're going to have trouble the rest of your thing. So it's like, that's what comes to mind is I'm the king.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you wanted the other king and you got him. Now it's Herod and not even Caesar.
Yes, you're both on the right track. It is that, as you're saying, he's saying, "I'm the true king," as you were just saying.
But he meant it in a different way.
But he's actually doing something else. Remember, in the Garden of Gethsemane, he allows himself to be arrested. He allows himself to be kissed by Judas. He allows himself to be bound. When the high priest Caiaphas asks him, "Are you the Christ?" Mm-hmm. He says, "Yes, I am." Pilate asks him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Yes, I am."
He lets them
say
it.
He voluntarily incriminates himself so that the plan of his condemnation, crucifixion, and death could go forward. That's love. That's love. You see? He willingly does it. Because Caiaphas is a religious man. He wants to hear a heresy so he can say, "You're condemned." Pilate is a political man. He cannot put to death somebody who has some religious ideas. Only if he's a political enemy of Rome can he be put to death.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why Christ says, "Yes, I'm a king." Mm-hmm. To make Pilate think, okay, you know.
Are they kind of trying to come in?
Yes. So that's the amazing thing here, the wonder of it all. And it again shows the extent of God's love and God's incredible willingness to be the sacrificial lamb. That's what's going on here. Yep. You know? Amazing, amazing. Hi, Mary.
Morning, Mary.
So, here you have again this amazing moment where Christ, in a sense, incriminates himself, even though he's absolutely innocent, and he's willing to be seen as a criminal in order for the plan of salvation to go forward.
But he's also telling the truth, right?
Absolutely.
He's letting them. I mean, he's sort of letting them speak the truth, which they don't believe, kind of out of their own mouths, sort of.
Exactly. It is as you say. And that's a very, you know, that's the height of irony right there,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
So, and the chief priests accused him of many things, but he answered nothing. right? Somebody accuses me, I'm going to probably immediately, what do you mean? I didn't do that. Trying to protect myself. No, he completely permits himself, right? Gives himself. Doesn't... It's incomprehensible, right? How can you, how can this happen? And again, this is God's love. Then Pilate asks him again, saying, "Do you answer nothing? See how many things they testify against you." But Jesus still answered nothing. So that Pilate marveled. Even Pilate now is thinking, wait a minute. Something is very strange here. Something's very different about this man. Why is he not defending himself? Now at the feast, he was accustomed to releasing one prisoner to them, whomever they requested. And there was one named Barabbas, who was chained with his fellow insurrectionists. These are political criminals.
Doesn't that mean like son of the father or something?
Yes, exactly. That's the irony. Barabba means son of the father. That's the irony. They had committed murder in the insurrection. Then the multitude, crying aloud, began to ask him to do just as he had always done for them. But Pilate answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" For he knew that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd so that he should rather release Barabbas to them. And Pilate answered and said to them again, "What then do you want me to do with him whom you call the king of the Jews?" So they cried out again, "Crucify him." Then Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" And they cried out more exceedingly, "Crucify him." So Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, released Barabbas to them, and he delivered Jesus, after he had scourged him, to be crucified.
Such a perfect example of the two different kinds of evil, like the political evil and the spiritual evil. The spiritual evil is worse, far worse, of course. And the political evil is just so base, you know, just knows it's doing wrong, but will just go ahead and do it anyway because, you know, the crowd wants it.
Right.
But then the spiritual evils behind it, the spiritual leaders are really plotting.
Very interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting observation. The Pilate knows he's sending an innocent man to death, but he doesn't care. He's kind of a coward, and he just doesn't want to deal with the crowd and just says, "Okay, here you go," even though he's sending another murderer back into the streets. And in some respects, this dynamic plays out, just as a side note, in the rest of history, right? How many times has religion been used to justify and to persecute, you know, and to commit genocide or whatnot? It's the same idea. And here it is.
I think he was trying to find a way out of this. He really didn't want to do
this. He didn't want to do this, you think so?
He didn't know why, but he didn't want to do it.
But he didn't want to not enough.
He didn't want it not bad enough to not do it. Right.
Not bad enough.
That's right. So let's go back now to 1 John, and we'll finish up there. We are at 1 John chapter 5. And we left off on verse 4. "And his commandments are not burdensome, for whatever is born of God overcomes the world." Just as Christ did, right? Here he is. Christ is overcoming the world and everything the world is throwing at him. The injustice, the lack of belief, the betrayal. He takes it all and he overcomes it. It doesn't crush him. It doesn't make him change his mind. He has overcome it because he's living in another, with another mind, another heart, over all of that, overcoming it, right? He's above it. He's risen above it. He's transcended it. And of course, because he's God, but he's also a human being, right? Of course, it would be easy for God to do that. But still, his human nature, his human side, had to overcome it as well by being one with his divine nature. And in the same way, we are given that power when we become Christians to overcome the world as he did. And all its evil, all its injustice, all its... It'll still happen to us as it happened to the martyrs, as it happened to the saints, it happened to righteous people, right? Many, many people were persecuted and even crucified just as Christ was, and betrayed and everything. But they went to their martyrdom with joy, with hope, with peace, not with fear and you know, being in despair, overcoming the world. And this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. Who is he who overcomes the world but he who believes that Jesus is the Son of God? Now you have this connection between faith, the true faith, that again, St. John here is so eager to protect his followers from, because already there's all these heresies. There's all these false teachings already happening, right? First century. He says, remember the true faith. Remember who Christ is. Remember what you have received. And all the apostles say this, Peter and Paul. Hold on, they say. Hold on to the faith, the pure faith that we gave to you. Don't be deceived by all these other teachers making up their own stuff. Stay with the apostles. Stay with the church that Christ founded. And that is our Orthodox faith. Okay. I think that's good for today. Any other questions on what we read so far?
That's why there's a bunch. That's why monks, monasteries exist, is because these people find that they can't live in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
And conform to what is demanded of them. But we've got the same problem. I mean, I don't have the courage to go become a monk or go to a monastery. But I can't live in this world without doing I fall.
Mm-hmm.
Without doing what?
Oh, I fall.
I fall, yeah.
I fail.
Sure.
And how in heaven's name is somebody like me that cannot completely overcome this world ever aspire to salvation?
Mm.
How in heaven's name can this happen? I don't know.
Right. Well, that's exactly a good point, because we cannot do it by ourselves. We simply stand before God in this humility, saying exactly what you're saying. I can't do this. It's only by his grace, it's only by his love that we are saved. I am.
That's the key, I think.
That's the key.
His grace.
Right, exactly.
It's not
exactly.
Due to me.
No. It's the more that I recognize that I can't, the more he can.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's this awareness, this knowledge, this dependence on him. That is essentially humility, what humility is. And that is what faith is too. Is recognizing that my need for God, yet doing my part. And that's the difference between what we as Orthodox do, is because when we say, here I am, as Moses said, right, to God. God calls his name, Moses or Abraham. Abraham, where are you? Here I am, Lord. We have to say that here I am on a daily basis. And when we are fasting,
I'm a failure.
But listen, when we are fasting, we are doing it, and we're saying, here I am, Lord. I'm doing, you know, not to get a reward, but I'm saying I'm active, I'm participating in this. Even though I'm failing, I'm still applying myself, I'm still trying, I'm still struggling. Not because I want to earn your love or earn your grace or earn salvation, but because I can't do anything else. I want to do something because I feel your presence, your love, I'm aware of your forgiveness, and I want to respond to that. I don't want to take it for granted and just make it cheap grace, as Bonhoeffer said. But I'm responding to it so that I'm doing my part as well, as a son and a daughter should, right? Don't you do chores? When you were growing up, didn't you do chores in the house? You did your part. It's the same idea. If I belong to the family of God, I got to do my part and only worry about me, not about anybody else. How's my prayer life? Am I fasting? Am I loving others? Am I forgiving? You see? Now I do that part and God does the rest. He showers us. He helps us. He helps us through the sacraments, which are his instruments, his vessels, to make contact with us, to incarnate, to touch us, to help us, sanctify us, right? We need that. Because on our own, we just admit it, we can't do nothing. That's actually salvific. It is only when we put in our effort and he meets us halfway with his grace through the sacraments that we are able to grow in holiness, grow in purification, and grow in sanctification, which is what we mean by salvation. Salvation for us does not mean escaping hell. Salvation means becoming like God again, becoming holy. That is what we mean by salvation. And it happens now in this life, and it continues in the next life. It's a journey, it's a process that begins now and continues on and on and on, from glory to glory, as St. Paul says. But we have to do our part, as you said, and admit, as you said, I'm a failure. I'm trying and I'm failing, but I'm going to get up and I'm going to do it again. If I fail, I'm going to get up again.
Keep trying.
Keep trying. Keep on, what's the phrase?
Keep on trucking.
Keep on keeping on. All right? That's the idea. With God's help.
And I hope it's that simple.
It is. In some sense, and it is that hard as well. But again, that's the reason of the community that St. John is pointing out. Says you all need to have a place where the faith is kept, where love exists, where support exists for one another, so that you can truly be children of God.